welcome everyone to the next episode of The Bonkers Brit. I'm delighted to welcome back Mary Karuba, and this is part two of our podcast. Her full bio is on part one, so episode 25. So if you'd like to go there, you can get her full bio, but you can also go to marykaruba.com. That's MaryKaruba.com. MaryKaruba.com, and then you can find out more information. So welcome back, Mary, to The Bonkers Brit. It's been really nice to have you back again. You were so popular that we thought we'd bring you back, and I hadn't finished talking to you about all your very interesting history.
Thank you, Claire. I'm really happy to be back, and I love this podcast that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. So some of the things we didn't get to talk about was all your work at Delancey Street and in the prisons. Now, I've got this unusual fixation, maybe lots of people have, about prisons. I loved, you know, films like Alcatraz and Escape from Alcatraz and all different prison films I just really love. Quite fascinated, in fact. Always want to go into prison, but hopefully not on the wrong end of a prison. Don't want to be in the orange overalls. Clash with my pink hair. But you have done an awful lot of work in prisons, haven't you?
Yes, and I always thought when I was a kid going in and out of juvenile halls and going to reform school and all that, I always assumed that I was going to end up in prison. That seemed to me to be an inevitability that I never even questioned. It just seemed to be the trajectory that I was on. So I always had a deep fascination with prisons. And when I was younger, I'd read books like Poetry from San Quentin, Letters from Folsom. And I was trying to prepare myself for when the day came that I was going to be in that environment and I wanted to be able to survive it. So I would practice how to be tough and how to survive. When I was like 14 or 15.
Putting on a wedding dress and having a Disney wedding, and you're practicing how to survive in prison.
It's so funny. I hear people talking about, yeah, when I was a kid, and I would think about getting married and having kids. And yeah. I never had any thoughts like that at all. Like, I just assumed that a regular life was not going to be available to someone like me. And so for me, it was all about prison. That was my aspiration.
And actually, you didn't end up.
No, I was very lucky. At 20, I was, you know, I'd been in reform school. I'd been on the streets. I'd been strung out on heroin. I hit bottom really, really, really hard. And at 20, I was lucky enough to discover a program called Delancey Street Foundation in San Francisco. And when you say drug treatment program, that is not a description of Delancey Street. It's a very poor way of trying to describe what it is, because at the time I went in, it was really more of a social movement than it was a treatment program. And the founder of Delancey Street, this very charismatic, brilliant, funny, wonderful guy who used to be a heroin addict in the streets of New York, had started Delancey Street with this incredible philosophy of one person helping another. So if you have 5 minutes clean and sober, you turn around and you help somebody that has 0 minutes. That's the entire way the program works.
Not a bit like AA.
Bit like AA in that it's very supportive, and not like AA at all in that it is extremely tough. And at the time I went in, basically the only people there were ex-convicts that had to be there because they were sentenced to Delancey Street as an alternative to going to prison. And if they could do 2 years at Delancey Street, they could possibly get out of their prison sentence. So there were a lot of convicts there and 20-year-old me.
Wow.
When I went in, and it really saved my life. I ended up living with them, being part of the organization for 7 years. I ended up learning that I was a good public speaker. They just threw me out into doing talks, and it turned out that I had a natural aptitude for it. So I developed this entire skill base during the 7 years that I was there that was pretty remarkable. Turned my whole life, my whole DNA, everything upside down.
Wow, isn't that amazing that something that seems really horrible and what a terrible situation can have that such amazing benefits? Because you have literally made a career out of public speaking in one form or another, haven't you?
That's right. I mean, when I was 23, and I'd been at Delancey Street for 3 years, and there was a guy that was supposed to go out and give a talk to a Knights of Columbus group. And at the last minute, something happened, and Dr. Mimi Silbert, the co-founder of Delancey Street, said, "Hey, Mary, go talk to that group of Knights of Columbus people." And I said, "Talk? What do you mean talk?" She said, yeah, just, you'll get up on stage, you'll, you know, tell a little bit about your own life and then tell about Delancey Street. And I'm like, what do you mean get up on a stage and talk in front of, I was terrified. And I get to this building with all, it was in New Mexico and a lot of rural kind of guys there, this Knights of Columbus group.
Can you just tell us what the Knights of Columbus are?
It's a community civic organization like Rotary Club or Seropon, where civic-minded individuals in the community form this group that does good work in the community. So they do fundraising, things like that. Just very civic-minded people. So I'm brought into this auditorium with like 100 guys sitting around, and I'm brought up onto a stage and onto a podium, and I start talking like, hello, my name is Mary Karuba. And then all of a sudden I looked out, and this thing happened that's happened for me ever since, which is that the individuals sort of disappeared, the individual people that were looking up at me, and I saw the audience. It was a relationship that's still my deepest relationship to this day, and my most long-term relationship. The place I've been most myself is with an audience. And that was the first time it ever happened. And I started speaking, and all of a sudden I was speaking as if I had written a script and memorized it and then blurted it out for an hour. Like no hesitation, no slowing down, no gaps, no nothing. It just, you know, people thought I'd been speaking for a long time, but that's what happens if you're given a gift, a natural aptitude for something, you don't have to work at it. So I've always tried to use it as a gift, and as a gift should be used, which is to then give it away.
How nice. Wow. And you spoke for an hour.
It was crazy. I mean, I was like, how am I even going to speak for 5 minutes? I told them all about my life. I told them about Delancey Street. I was funny. I didn't know I was funny. I didn't find out I was funny until I was in my 20s. And then, of course, I ended up becoming a professional stand-up comedian. Turns out I am pretty funny, but I never knew it because I had such a desperate, awful, horrible life. There wasn't a lot of laughter or sitting around the fire making up songs. Things that happen to normal people. For me, it was all about survival and hiding out and trying to run away and trying to save my life, trying to kill myself. It was all about that kind of stuff, you know?
So how did Delancey Street particularly, what did they do that was so life-changing for you? How, because you're saying it's a social movement, it's difficult to understand what that really means in
practical terms. Thing was, I never knew. I thought everything was about me. Before, you know, when you have a very abusive background and a very difficult life and all that, you live in this world where you're the center, right? And all the things that happen to you define your world and how you feel about things, right? And so it's a little complicated to explain because most drug treatment programs have a format. You go to groups so many times a week, you work on this, you get educated, you do that. It's all fine and dandy. Delancey Street wasn't about any of those things. Drugs were never discussed. That wasn't the issue. It was assumed from the day you stepped in the door that you weren't using drugs. So drugs were no longer your issue. You have a living problem. If you can't live without shooting heroin into your veins, you've got a problem living. And so Delancey Street taught people how to live. How do you move in the world? How do you treat other people? It's not about going to a class and learning about, you know, the mechanics of drug addiction. It's about reaching a hand out and helping somebody else in the world as a way to help yourself. That was the entire thrust of Delancey Street. Each one, teach one. So each person had a responsibility to turn around and teach the person that knew just a little bit less than them. And that's how the chain worked at Delancey Street. And it was powerful. And we were involved with the community, getting out the vote, helping at food banks, helping when there were community crises. And we always lived in the nicest neighborhoods, bought mansions and beautiful properties. John Mahar's philosophy was you can't cure a drunk in a bar, can't cure a drug addict in the gutter. You have to elevate people. So everybody at Delancey Street was required to dress well, to always be made up well, to look nice. We lived in mansions and resort ranches and beachfront properties. And it was just a very unusual kind of situation where the entire focus was on helping other people as a way to help yourself. The other primary teaching tool at Delancey Street that changed my life was learning about the principle of acting as if. Most people are trying to think their way into right behavior, and you can't do it, but you can act your way into right thinking. You can just pretend, just act as if. Whatever it is, act as if you're a calm person, a patient person, a giving person, a loving person. When I was trying to learn compassion, that was what my TED Talk was about compassion and and how I developed that. And when I first learned that, I just had to pretend to be a compassionate person until I could get to that within myself. Mm. So Delancey Street was life-changing.
That is quite forward thinking, because that was a while ago. When was it? What year was it that you went there?
Yeah, that was 77. I was there 77 to 84.
I suppose it was the movement of love, I suppose, and in San Francisco, that was probably very, very in. But, you know, in England, when
Delancey Street was not about any of that. Oh, no, Delancey Street cared nothing about all the free love and the groovy.
But the concept of love, if you like, and give it was starting then, if you like, and San Francisco was a crucial spiritual place to move the movement of thought, if you like, forward. But it still was very early to be doing that. I mean, I think that's an amazing concept, and I try and do that too. But for that year, it was quite far-reaching. I can't think of the right
word. It really was. I mean, it's very progressive for the time, and you can see it's still doing extremely well 40 years later. You know, I think Delancey Street is 45 now. They have facilities all over the world and just doing incredible work. They've never accepted state or federal funding. They own and operate all of their own businesses that the residents work in to gain marketable job skills. I mean, it's just extraordinary all the way around. Nothing like a drug treatment program.
Amazing, isn't it? It's so good. Yeah. And it's to give people respect for themselves, isn't it?
Well, you act your way into it. You get a guy in off the street that still has blood dripping down his arm from shooting heroin in his veins. You put him in a suit, clean him up a little bit, cut his hair, tell him to sit properly at dinner and use his silverware. That's the starting point, right? That's the starting point. Changing your whole image, changing the way you act in the world. No street behavior was allowed at all. So you really had to make a significant shift.
And what if someone did do that, if they did act out and go back and shoot up heroin? Were they chucked out?
Oh, yes. Yes, there were only two rules: no drug use, no violence or threats of violence. Those two rules, automatic out. Yeah. And you know, it's really interesting. Delancey Street has never had an act of violence, and they've got the most violent population that one could ever imagine having. And I'm talking over 45 years later, there's still never been an act of violence. And it just shows you the power of the group. Right, because it's not like there's a bunch of staff members controlling a bunch of residents. The entire operation is owned and operated by the residents.
Why don't all the prisons do that? I mean, wouldn't that solve a lot of problems?
That's what we were at. That's why I went into a prison and started a program based on Delancey Street, looking at whether or not you could change and reduce recidivism rates, you know, the rate at which people go back to prison. Mm-hmm. If you change their environment within the prison and taught them skills that people learn at Delancey Street, could you impact recidivism rates? And so that's what I was tasked with when I started. Yeah, it's Solano Prison.
And it did work. Did it reduce them?
That's still going. Well, it's new. It's still going on. I just started it. That was like 4 years ago. So they've been going for about 4 years now, and it's doing well. And there hasn't been an active. That's the other thing too. Not one act of violence in that cell block. We went into Solano, took over a whole cell block, accepted 100 men into the program. The correctional officers hated it, warned us constantly at the beginning about the fights and this, because we didn't use the correctional officers. We ran our own alternate reality sort of within the prison. And so they warned us I was going to be in danger. There was going to be violence there. And 4 years later, still not.
So amazing. So talk a bit more about the program then. So tell me what you did and what's
let me tell you this first about trying to do anything inside a prison. It's very difficult in the United States to do anything of meaning within the prison systems because of the gangs. The gangs are what rule the prisons. And you can bring a program in and get people involved and start to teach them something, but their first master is always going to be the gang. Always. And so you're trying to teach people about honesty and about treating people decently while their gang member is telling them to go shiv somebody at lunchtime, right? Their gang leader is giving them instructions, go, you know, stab this guy, go do this, steal this, do that. So it's very challenging to try to bring in something like Delancey Street to a place like prison. But what we did from the very beginning was just establish the boundaries just like they are in Delancey Street. No street language. And listen, that's quite an enterprise when you're talking about inmates, because they talk nothing but street language. So I had a lot of conversations with people like this. Hey, Bob, how you doing? Hey, you know what I'm saying? So, no, Bob, I don't know what you're saying. I asked you how you're doing. You feel me? No, Bob, I don't feel you because I'm standing here. You're standing there. I don't feel you. Physically, we're not touching, and you haven't said anything yet that makes me feel. And like we'd have these conversations where we break down everything they're saying, right? Or when they would swear, I would, and I won't say it now because we're on your lovely podcast, but I would break down the swear word, you know, and like how they used it. And so from the very beginning, they had to speak with respect. They couldn't bring in all those prison attitudes. And we started little by little teaching them Delancey Street. And I taught them all public speaking skills. So we had a public speaking class and they all stood at the podium and got recorded speaking. And yeah, some of them got really, really good at it too. Really good.
And so could you not have got the gang leaders to be part of this?
Well, that's a big part of what we did in the very beginning was to connect with them, and they can appreciate what we're doing and support what we're doing in their own way, but they're not going to give up their power and they're not going to give up. They're in it for the long run. I went in and I did a few years and I left. All those people, they're still there. They were there years before I got there. They're going to be there years after. So they're playing a very long game in prison. And it meant a lot to them and does mean a lot to them. But the issue with the gangs is very difficult because you can't get a pure experience of working with the person when they're indebted to someone else who's got a completely different philosophy than what you're trying to teach. So yeah, it's challenging.
Because the gangs, if they're not part of a gang, then they're not safe.
Well, you have to be in prison. The only way to not be part of a gang is if you've already made your name. And you can step out with respect. You're allowed to step out. Or if you're super religious, some people pretend like they are just to get out of the gangs. But, you know, they're pretty bright in prison. They can figure you out. But if you're super religious and you just really couldn't hurt somebody or you couldn't be violent or whatever, then you get out too. But otherwise, pretty much everybody has to affiliate. They have to do it immediately. And it has to be completely black and white. This is my group. You can't talk to anybody in that group. In our facility in the cell block, we had to make a rule that people had to play games together because that was the only way they could play games like they wanted to at the card together and not get in trouble with their gang leaders. Because usually if you're black, you can't talk to the Mexican guy who's a northerner, but you can talk to the Mexican guy who's a southerner. If you're the Mexican, you can talk to this one, but not, you know, it's a very strict set of rules. And then Delancey Street comes in and like, hey, kumbaya, we're all in this together. You know, everybody sits at the table together. We eat together. We talk together. There's no separation.
So then how did that work for the people that were in the Delancey Street program to then go back to be part of the gang? How could they make that transition?
You know who it's the most difficult for? The people that really get what Delancey Street is trying to do in there and really want to be a part of it. They feel it. They just like I did when I went in, it helped me develop a whole new life because of what I felt. Well, they feel something too. They want to be part of it, but they can only go so far. So they have to be very sneaky. They've got to sort of play these two masters against each other. And until you can do a program that is completely separated from the prison population, that's the way it's going to be. And then the problem...
You could actually, you're thinking that having a cell block, say for 100 people, and they never interact with the rest of the prison.
Right. But see, in prison, when you have a cell block like that that doesn't interact, that's a snitch cell block. Those are the snitches or the child molesters or the people that nobody wants anything to do with. You don't want to be associated with that. So it's very, very delicate. That's why we didn't do the separation because nobody would have joined. Nobody would have come. They're not going to set themselves up to look like they're in a, what's it called? I forget what it's called, what they call that kind of building, but it's very derogatory. Right. And so we had to keep it where they're still part of the yard life and all that.
So do you think if you could get a prison or make a prison, if you like, from scratch, that's what it was, and the whole prison was done on that?
Oh, you could do it. You could easily do it.
Then you think those people would never reoffend?
You could easily reform people. Just like a lot of them are going to reoffend because that's just the way of human nature. There's a certain percentage that are not going to, they're constitutionally incapable of changing. and you're always going to have them, but you get a much greater percentage that is going to make it when you give them that opportunity. And it's hard to give them that opportunity in a prison setting without carving them out as like snitches or something. That's so the worst thing that could happen to you. See, they have to think about their reputation for the rest of their lives there. A lot of them are doing life. So they're playing a very long game. They might want to be part of your little program, but not if it's going to hurt their reputation.
No. So, I mean, would Delancey Street ever consider having, well, I don't know whether it's,
I don't think Delancey Street would, but what you're talking about is exactly what needs to happen for any kind of true prison reform. The system is so corrupt. It's sort of like Washington in a way, where the system is so corrupt and money is involved in such a disgusting way. And the whole system itself is so wrong that you basically have to start over if you're going to change it. And I just don't see that happening. That's the problem. This system is so
particularly bad in America. I mean, yep. It wasn't almost any other country. There are so many people in prison, and often so many black people in prison.
Well, you have the racism element here. You have the racism element, the black people that were brought over on ships, right? And the systemic racism that has happened all the way through. You definitely see that in prisons. The proportions of people of color in prison are just ridiculous. Mm. It's ridiculous. And you really see, when you're in a prison, you really do see how being white and having money is, you know, if you're in that system, the criminal justice system at all, you definitely want to be white and have money, because otherwise you're going to prison and you're staying there.
Horrible, isn't it?
And you know, the whole time I was at CPS, I never saw a wealthy person convicted of child molest or child abuse. Not once.
What
not once.
You didn't see, just because they were wealthy, they didn't get convicted.
Yeah, they get the good lawyers, and you go into these little county juvenile courts, right, with the county lawyers and the county judge and everything. And here comes in this slick, you know, attorney. This, you know, $800 an hour attorney comes in, sort of intimidates everybody. They would always get them off. If you had money, I never saw a wealthy person go to prison for child abuse.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's horrible.
Oh, a lot of times they don't even get caught. They're more protected. They've got their houses with the gates, with the thing. They're more protected. Poor people are much more sort of out there in the world and noticed. They're on food stamps. Maybe they get welfare. They come to the notice of people more than somebody with money. It is a tragically unfair, unbalanced system, our criminal justice system in the United States. It really is.
It's, I don't know. Because, I mean, more and more and more people are going to prison, and they get more and more crowded. And so obviously what that is, it's not working.
And it makes them so much worse. I mean, anybody...
Yes, it trains them how to be a criminal, doesn't it?
Yeah, you can see it. There was this kid in our program who was 18, I mean, barely 18. And he was so pretty. You know, he was like one of those boys that's just really pretty, you know, with the features and everything. And I remember looking at this kid and just thinking what he was going to have to go through and what he was going to have to do to protect himself and everything. And what if that kid could have really had a chance, though? You know, what if instead of spending all his time in prison figuring out how not to get raped and how to protect him, how to run hustles and all that stuff you have to learn, how to cut his hair so he's not so attractive, whatever he's doing, instead of doing all that, what if he was learning something, learning marketable skills, learning why he did the things he did in the first place, learning why his family is the way it is, learning what he can do differently in the future? What if he had that chance, that little 18-year-old kid, Claire, you know? But that guy's going to end up being just another criminal out there like all the rest of them.
I remember reading something about, you know, tribes in Africa. And it was, you know, what a lot of, you know, wealthy white people think are just, you know, like the third world and stuff like that, and not clever and intelligent. And when they were pregnant, the women, they would sing a birth song to their child, and they would always sing the same song. And that when the child was born, they would sing that song, and it was the child's song. And everyone would know that in the village. And so when somebody got to be, you know, teenagers, and they got to be horrible, and they did something bad, no matter what it was, they would get the person, they'd put them in the middle of a circle, and for 24 hours or a period of time, I can't remember how long it was now, they would sing the birth song. And not only would they do that, every single person in the village would say something about what was good about that child.
Wow.
And after, like, even however wow. stubborn and whatever they were about they were doing, it's very difficult, and they'd end up crying, and then they wouldn't do it anymore. I mean, how amazing is that? That's so far-reaching what any in you know the first world do ever do to anyone. But that's what a child wants, isn't it?
When you think about it, what are our ideal circumstances for learning? Is it somebody telling you you're a scumbag and to shut the hell up and stand in a corner, or is it somebody singing a loving birth song to you and telling you what's good about you?
Yeah.
It's like the difference between prison and a healing environment.
Yeah.
You could bring that healing into a prison setting, but it certainly doesn't happen now.
For sure. And any child at any point, like for your childhood, if you'd just been told what an amazing, you know, spirited person you were, that would have made us such a difference. I remember my daughter when she was two. I mean, she was always a really lovely, easy baby, but she did have a little bit of a stubborn streak to her. And I remember thinking, oh God, she's quite hard work sometimes. And you know, she wouldn't always do what I wanted her to do, obviously. And my ex-father-in-law, I wonder, just made some comment that really struck home with me. He said, you don't want her just being a yes person. It's nice to have a bit of spirit, isn't it? When she's older, she'll need that. And it suddenly dawned on me, of course, she's going to need a little bit of spirit because you have to get through the world. You have to do stuff. You don't want to be pushed around and being a doormat. And I thought, that is brilliant. You should honour the individuality of a child and not try and stamp it down.
Oh, I mean, really, when you think about it, like, think about my childhood, and what if my parents hadn't been so overwhelmed, or what if they had more ego maturity or more patience or whatever? What a difference it would have made as a child to be told, God, you're so lively, you're so spirited, that's so fun, I love the way you're so curious, oh, that's so fun, you know?
Yeah, make it a positive. I mean, I didn't always do it with my kids, to be honest. I wasn't the perfect mother, but I did really try. You know, the acting as if and everything, you know, and just to really say, God, you're really amazing. And I always made a real point of telling them how good they were at drawing or how creative they were. And I remember my son, we found out he had dyslexia. And I got this book called The Gift of Dyslexia, because dyslexia is a gift. I mean, Richard Branson's got dyslexia, and you get to see the world in a different way. You can see it in like 3D. And so you don't just look at it in the 2D way that I can sometimes do. You can actually see all around. So it's a massive boon for a problem solver, or if you're into animation or art or anything like that. And I remember telling my son how amazing it is he's got dyslexia. And I told him, it's really good. It makes it slightly more difficult to read and find your letters, but it's the most amazing thing. You're so lucky. And I made a big thing about it. And he went to school that day. He said, it's so great. Because also he was great because he thought he was just thick and stupid at school. And when he found out he had a label and he was dyslexic, for
right.
him.
Right.
Mom, I've got dyslexia. He said, I'm really good. And we made it a big thing. And, I genuinely believe it is a gift. And this book was really helpful as well. Any kids have got dyslexia, go and read the book, The Gift of Dyslexia.
That's so good.
Go and Google that. I can't remember which one, but it changed my life and Tom's life. Because that is what you need to know, isn't it? That every negative, if like, has a flip side, which is a positive. Like if you're very impatient, that there was a flip side to that. And it means you want to get stuff done and, you're not willing to wait around and you tend to, be out there a bit more.
Well, that's sort of like how the best thing about you is always the worst thing about you too. Like I'm really good at speaking, and whenever I get in trouble, it's always my mouth. The thing that's the best about me is the worst.
Yes. I know exactly what you mean.
It's always been the mouth, Claire.
my mouth always got me into trouble too. Into trouble. Not quite as bad trouble as you got into, luckily.
But the whole prison thing, it's really such an amazing thing to go in there and really get to know people, because you see that they're just people like they are anywhere else. You go into any neighborhood, you're going to find the lazy guy, you're going to find the OCD guy, you're going to find the guy that reads poetry. You know, it's like the same thing you have out here, you have in there. You see that they are just human beings, just people. And what prison does is it continually reinforces what a piece of crap they are, how they don't deserve anything, and how they'll never have anything. That's why they end up going in and out, in and out, in and out.
Yeah, why wouldn't they?
And they have to be animals to survive in there for the most part, unless you're real, real slick. You know, if you're in prison, especially for the first time, you've got to do what you've got to do. And some of the things you've got to do are just horrid.
No, horrible. My husband was watching a program a while ago, and it was about a reporter, I think it was a reporter, or journalist, whatever, who went into the worst prisons around the world. And he spent, I think, a week there. And literally, some of them, particularly in South America was
Central America, yeah,
awful. I mean, he was genuinely terrified. He was genuinely terrified for his life a lot of the time. And the conditions, I mean, we think the conditions in America are bad. I mean, I don't know enough about
that.
But in there, it was like there was mud on the floor. There was no sleeping. There was like 60 guys, violent, you know, terrifying, you know, badly behaved guys, all stuck in a overly, really hot as well, small room with maybe 8 beds. And they were just concrete and mud and dirt and smell and boredom and not enough food, not enough water, and nothing to do but punch the person next to you. And he had to live like that. And they all lived like that. And it was just awful. I remember in one prison, they were trying to do something better. So they had this really awful prison on one side, and then you crossed a road and there was this new prison that was being built, that had been built, that was treating people as human beings, giving them proper clothes to wear, proper places to live. They could walk around, they could do jobs. And it was just so marked. It was really successful.
Well, that's just it, Claire. The biggest thing in prison is the humiliation. Mm. It's and how you can't get anything that you need. You're treated like sort of like the dirt beneath someone's shoes. So I remember when I got there, there was this young guy that's working on construction, and he's got so many holes in his shoes that it's really hurting when he's out on the rocks and doing all this stuff. And the person that works in the, you know, place where they're going to dispense another pair of shoes just won't give him another pair. Like, for whatever reason, right? It's like all these petty power plays like that constantly that you can't do anything about. You can't, or the correctional officers will have everybody freeze in place, right? Like, let's say there's some emergency or anything, the whole place goes on lockdown. So everybody sits where they are. And you might be sitting out in a hot yard with the sun beating down on you over 100 degrees. You can't move. And the correctional officers will drag it out because it's fun for them, because they don't have to work and they can hang out in cell blocks and everybody's accounted for. They're all talking to each other and goofing around. And so you're humiliatingly just sitting there in the sun, knowing that you don't need to be there, right? There's no good reason for it except somebody wants to humiliate you or wants to go have fun for 5 minutes, and you have to take it. And that happens to you every single day. Or somebody, a correction officer, doesn't like you, so they come in and they take the one precious object that you have in your cell, maybe a radio or something, and confiscates it on some trumped up thing and takes your one thing that means anything to you. It's like constant, daily, multiple humiliations that you have to swallow. And that's how I lived my whole childhood. So I know how they feel. And I really felt it when I was in there for them. And they get very philosophical to be able to deal with it. They have to, because otherwise you would lose your mind, Claire.
I suppose a lot of people listening might have been, if you like, the victim of somebody who's behaved really bad, who's in prison, and they might have a different opinion about some of these people, if they've been raped or if they're a close one has been killed, you know, I mean, how?
Well, I have to say, with rape and murder, Delancey Street doesn't really take that on, and I haven't taken it on behalf of Delancey Street. We don't accept in people that have rape charges or murder charges, because that is sort of a different level of therapy and involvement and engagement that Delancey Street just doesn't do. Mm-hmm. And so, but so many of these guys that are doing life sentences, we just really wanted to help give them a different way to live in prison, but they are still going to be in prison for their lives, for their entire lives.
Right. Gosh. I mean, it must be, if you know that prison is going to be your life forever with no chance of parole, how do you contain?
You get very philosophical. You get very philosophical. You play the long game. The patience of these people, Claire, it's unbelievable, because they have to be. They, you know, when they go to the parole hearings and they get turned down, then they have to go back. You get very patient. And yes, there are a lot of people in prison that have done a lot of horrible things, but the people that I focus on that make up the majority of people in prison are those people that are there because of drugs or because of some kind of mental health issue. Mm. Those are people that you can help. Those are people that aren't hopeless cases. They're not going to go out and murder 20 people if they get set free from prison. They have a chance. And those are the people that we work with.
Right. Quite a heavy little discussion there, wasn't it?
They're all so funny as hell, though. I mean, they really are funny.
Well, that's some funny stories. at least one to finish on.
That is so difficult because I can't think of anything off my head that would be funny. And so much of it was so deadly serious. But one thing I do remember is that there were a lot of moments of laughter. And the guys really liked it when I did things you're not supposed to do in prison. Like in prison, you're not supposed to notice anything. So if you see somebody next to you doing something weird or somebody next to you like beating somebody up or something, you're not supposed to see it. And so they loved it when I would just call something out and say, hey, how come you're doing that thing? And it would shock them. They live in this environment where nobody says anything about anything to anybody for any reason. And so they really enjoy that. It helps sort of open them up a little bit and loosen them up. And then the thing about language was so funny, especially the you feel me thing. I'm telling you, can make a whole paragraph in prison out of you hear me and you feel me. That's the whole paragraph. I saw this guy, right? You feel me? You hear me? I tell this guy, I said, listen, mofo, you feel me? I mean, they will say it so many times, and I had to break them of that habit.
Oh,
so that was a lot of fun. And I invested in this equipment system, so they'd have like a microphone and it would project out and they would stand up at the podium. And that was a beautiful thing to
see.
Do you
know what the equivalent outside is? It's for young people. It's the word like.
Yeah.
The word like is put into so many people's conversations. My husband and I went to see a storytelling show, and it was young people, and all my husband could do was count like how many times they said like, and after 46 he gave up. 46 likes in a 10-minute presentation.
It's the same thing in prison. It's you feel me, you hear me, and mofo, the long version of mofo.
Oh right.
You hear a lot of, and you know, they liked it how like sort of confrontive I was. That's like a Delancey Street style. Like I came in one day and this guy had gotten this big weird tattoo on his head. And I said, oh my gosh, I didn't know you never want to leave prison. God, I thought you wanted to, you want to be in prison your whole life. Right. And like, and nobody talks to them like that. Nobody does that. And like that guy, I remember later that day, I got word from other people that he was real upset the way I talked to him, you know? But what it is, and we worked it all out, but they're just not used to anybody dealing with anything in prison. Everybody keeps to themselves. They don't bother with anybody else. And then we came in and just shook them.
But you are one of those people, Mary, just generally, it makes me die laughing, but you have no filter. You just say what's on the top of your head. I remember we were out with a friend of mine that you didn't know, and she was saying something about writing a book about. So I said, and why would that be interesting? And luckily she thought it's funny too, but I just still think it's the funniest thing. Cause it was just like, why would that be interesting?
I've sort of developed this style of just telling the truth. Like I never have to look over my shoulder. I never have to worry about what I've said. I never have to try to remember a lie. But the downside to that is that sometimes things will just come out, you know, and I think they're very clever and lovely, but not everybody does.
No, not everyone does. I'm sure. I mean, it makes me laugh a lot because I like people who are just out there. And I'm not very good at reading between the lines. So I need people to be very, you know,
Well, you know, the older I get, the more desperate I am to just have strong people around me that can just be honest and tell the truth. You know, when you're a really strong person and you're around passive aggressive people, they will tend to make themselves your victim. You know what I mean? Like they won't speak up. They won't take care of themselves. They won't speak up for themselves. And then they'll get upset with you for being sort of a strong personality. And so I find it's really interesting to just try to be honest and try to be straightforward, but not do it in a way that's hurtful.
Yeah, well, I've always been a bit of a blurter. I've always blurted stuff out. And, no, I didn't mean to say that. Sorry. And it can be really hurtful. I mean, I have definitely offended quite a few people, I know.
Yeah, that I wouldn't want to do that. That's the one downside to just saying whatever comes to your mind is that, you know, a few times it has been hurtful and I don't want to do that. You know?
No, and so I've had to really, and particularly since coming to California, because I had no idea how un-PC I was. I thought I was, you know, quite evolved and, you know, not racist and all the rest of it. And then I came to California and it was like, oh my God, I had no idea. I mean, I think particularly where I am in California, in the North Bay, it's utterly so PC, it's ridiculous.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's a little bit too much for me, but But it did, it has taught me so much because I really was terrible. I make them laugh at work on purpose now. It used to be accidental. But now I've realised. And I made them laugh about how I, you know, how the English, for example, are really rude about the French, you know, or any culture that's different from England, and we take the mickey out of it, and it's not, and it must be worse because we're the best. I mean, it's really arrogant and horrible, but, and I make them laugh at work, and they're all a little bit shocked, you know. I've learned how now not to do that, and how hurtful it is for the people who are in that culture. And when I go back to England now and visit, I realise how bad.
You really see it, yeah.
And I've got a bit, a sharp intake of breath, like my co-workers. I always know that I've dropped, made a huge faux pas. There's this sharp intake of breath around me. And I'm like, what have I said? What have I said? You
know? Well, you know, it's a constant learning thing, isn't it? Like, I always assumed that I couldn't be racist because I'm Arab and I'm from San Francisco, born and raised, and there's so much diversity there. And so I just always assumed I wasn't racist. And then I started really examining my thoughts and the way I think about things. And I realized, oh, I have racist thoughts. Like, I didn't even realize it till I examined it a little more deeply. Yeah. And so coming to California from England can help you examine things more deeply.
It did.
The difference is so stark, isn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely.
And the way of joking and everything.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I find out I have to, particularly sense of humour, I have to go back to England and have my niceness knocked out of me a little bit. Because my family, particularly, both my sisters, love them to death. They're very, very honest. They will not hold back in telling me what they think, particularly my older sister. She's a very good humbler, because just as I'm thinking, oh, I'm doing quite well, she'll knock me down and that's it. Oh no, I'm still a bit shite.
Is that the one who's a nun?
No, that's my younger sister. Okay. She's really good too, but she says it in a lovely, sweet way. My older sister is she's a bit like you. She's very blunt and she just says it like it is. And it's like, oh, right, yeah. And she's right. I mean, most of the time she's right. But, you know, it's like, oh, right, okay.
I said to my sister and her partner the other day, I was asking about some friend of theirs, and I go, you know, the big one with the baby, you know? It was just like the first thing I thought, the big one with the baby. And they thought that was so funny. Like, they laughed about that so hard, the big one with the baby. And it's like, sometimes I don't even know what's coming out of my mouth. Yeah. Me, that sounded perfectly fine, but I guess it came across a little different. Yeah.
It's fine, unless you were the big one with the baby.
I guess so.
And you've lost all your baby weight.
But the English sense of humor is a little bit different than just the sense of humor itself. The sensibilities of people are different, I think.
Yes, you have to learn to laugh at yourself from a very young age. And you have to, and a lot of it is very sarcastic. And
self-deprecating. A lot of self-deprecating stuff. Everything's I'm sorry.
No, you can't be bigging yourself up like you do in America. I mean, because that is just really wrong. And if people start doing that, then they are ripped to shreds by their friends, if they've got any friends. You know, if you keep doing that, you don't have a lot of friends.
it's like in police departments and fire departments, there's a certain culture where if anybody is sort of pointed out for praise or sort of pulled out of the pack, they're just mercilessly abused by everybody. It sounds like the same thing in England.
But if you big yourself up, it's the worst thing of all.
Yes.
Blowing your own trumpet is just terrible sin.
And over here, that's like, hey,
it's a way of life, isn't it? Business.
Yeah, it's a way of life.
I mean, it's a much better thing to do, because then that's why, you know, Americans are so good in business, because they've been, well, a lot of them, obviously not you, Mary, but a lot of parents really big their kids up, and they're taught how to do that and to say what their skills are. I mean, it's, you know, for an English person to say, I'm good at something, is excruciating. I mean, really, sort of, you know, and then make some joke about it. And that means I'm really good at doing something. Whereas, you know, in America, I just go, I'm really good at doing this. Very odd. We could go about comedy for another whole, maybe we'll do another whole session on that one.
Oh, on comedy?
Our time now, Mary.
You know, out of all the difficult things in my life, and you know, I've had a very difficult life, out of all the difficult things, I would say doing comedy is the hardest thing I've ever done. Out of everybody. Comedy, it's horrible. It's a nightmare.
It's so subjective, isn't it, comedy? What one person thinks is funny, somebody else doesn't.
And having to get a laugh every 15 to 20 seconds, which is what you have to do if you're professional, you know, that pacing, that's a killer. I mean, that is really hard. Comedy.
For one nanosecond, I thought I might go into comedy about 2 years ago when I came out of my English you know, tortoise shell shell, thought, okay, I'm just bloody going to go out there and say it. I'm going to be a comedian. And that was like, it's the most scary thing. It was more scary than if I come out as being gay or a mass murderer. But coming out, I want to be a comedian professionally, was the worst. And so I came out and did that. And then within 5 seconds, I discovered that you've got to make a joke every 15 seconds. You've got to go and stand in the men's clubs. You've got to go to the comedy clubs. And I thought, I don't want to do that. So thank God I stopped that. And I discovered you can do funny storytelling, which is absolutely perfect. So now that's...
Well, like the night we met, at the Moth Storytelling,
yes,
in Oakland, right?
San Francisco.
In San Francisco. That's right. In the Mission District, right? Yeah. Okay. And you and I, it was my first time there. Was that your first time at that one?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So it was both our first time and we both won. We got an exact
high score, didn't we? The same score. Well, yeah.
Same score. Yeah. We tied.
But then you won.
they have to pick a winner. And so.
Those bastards.
The best. I know. I always thought I would have been so resentful if they would have picked you.
I hated you at the time.
I mean, like, why pick her over me, or why pick me over her? If we got, I think they should split it.
It was very arbitrary, I have to say. And I've seen it happen. And again, if two people get the highest score, and then they arbitrarily make someone that winner. And I don't understand why, because why can't both people go on to the Grand Slam? I don't know why.
Like that happened for me at the Moth Grand Slam in Los Angeles. I went back for the Grand Slam.
Went to the Grand Slam on that, on the basis of that, was it?
What? What's that?
I'm bitter. No.
Well, I went on to do the grants, but this was in LA.
Oh, so it was the LA one, yeah.
So I did the Grand Slam and I tied with another woman and they gave it to her. So I got my comeuppance.
Yes, you did, didn't you? See, no, I don't mean that.
If
we hadn't both tied, I probably wouldn't have got to know you so well. So it's been,
right.
Maybe that was a better gift than winning the Grand Slam.
I know. Well, you know, meeting you is so wonderful because you're definitely a unique and total personality unto yourself. I really like that. There's not a lot of Claire Hennessy's around.
Well, I'm certainly not more, definitely not another Mary Karuba.
Let's hope not. That's, yeah, this is a small state. Yeah, let's keep it like that.
No, big personality in a tiny little body. Yeah. Anyway, Mary, that definitely all we have time for. I can hardly talk anymore.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you for having me on.
You've been a lovely guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Claire.
And thank you so much for everyone for listening and watching, if I've managed to work out how to put this on YouTube. And I'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.